This is Len Edgerly on October 25th, 2009 in Cambridge, Massachusetts with a Kindle Chronicles extra, which I recorded yesterday at the Boston Book Festival 2009. This impressive event featured workshops, readings, and lots of book signings in venues located in and around Copley Square in Boston. The recording that I've got for the TKC extra today is the first portion of a panel that I attended at the Boston Book Festival titled The Future of Reading. It was moderated by David Pogue, who is technology columnist for the New York Times. You'll hear David speak first, laying out a lively overview of ebooks that I know you'll probably find provocative, especially since he flat out states that the Nook, quote, is better than the Kindle. How he figured that out without ever having read a book on a Nook is beyond me. And I seriously doubt that the gang at Amazon are, as David suggested, hiding under a coffee table because of the Nook's introduction. But, you know, if he's a knowledgeable guy and he's really a funny speaker. He's an excellent speaker. So it's a take on the situation in ebooks involving the Kindle and the rest of the competition that is pretty entertaining to listen to. The second speaker that you'll hear in this recording is John Orwant, who was formerly chief technology officer at O'Reilly Media and is now engineering manager for Google Books, Google Magazines, and Google Patents. He is talking about Google's dream of seeing every book in the that's ever been written and published in the cloud, and he gives an overview of the entire landscape of the 100 million books that have been published since the time of Gutenberg. He also talks about the Google scanning settlement, which is now in its final stages of seeking a compromise that will satisfy all the parties. The final speaker at the session is Brewster Kahle, K-A-H-L-E, digital librarian and co-founder of the Internet Archive. He began with a snide and, I thought, pretty gratuitous crack at Google's expense and then proceeded to portray the Internet Archive as the only way to assure a rich future for books. I honestly found him a little bit insufferable in his self-righteousness, but I'm sure that the archive is worth understanding, and I may have let the guy's demeanor lead me to underestimate the value of his project. The second part of the Future of Reading session, I recorded some of it, but I'm not going to include it in this extra. It frankly devolved into a fairly crass pitching of products, I thought. Sony's top ebooks guy, Steve Haber, pretended to be speaking on behalf of the entire sector, but he made sure he had a sample of all three major Sony readers to hold up, even quoting the price on one of them. He looked like an industry statesman compared with an embarrassing presentation by Neil Jones, the CEO of Interread, which is the company that created the Cooler Reader. He spent most of his time reminding the audience of several hundred that had gathered there at the Boston Public Library that David really did slay Goliath, and therefore Cooler Reader was going to end up dominating this industry. Mary Lou Jepsen, founder and CEO of Pixel Qi, that's P-I-X-E-L-Q-I, did an okay job pitching her company's e-ink competing screen, but by that time I'd grown pretty tired of product pitches and I had retreated to my iPhone to read my Kindle version of The Lincoln Lawyer, which is a really good courtroom thriller by Michael Connelly that I've been reading. If you listen all the way to the end of this, your reward will be a chance to hear David Pogue accompanying himself on piano singing Don't Cry for Me, Cupertino, a brilliant send-up of Steve Jobs' return to Apple after his earlier exile. David Pogue, in addition to being a talented chronicler of technology, I guess his real love at Yale was musicals, and he actually spent some time on Broadway having some serious success there before he ended up becoming a technology journalist. So any chance he gets to sing a song and play the piano, he takes full advantage of it. And this was an amazing presentation that he did, which marked between the first and the second half of the workshop. I hope you enjoy this Kindle Chronicles extra. And I'll be working on the regular show for the usual Friday slot later this week.
I'm David Pogue. I'm the weekly tech columnist for the New York Times, and I will be your MC today for this extremely interesting panel on the future of reading, whether it means electronical or not. And we have some incredible panelists and a really bad projector. we have On or Want. It's actually John. John is from Google Books and Google Magazines. He's the author of the best-selling Programming Pearl, former technology officer at my publisher, O'Reilly. And he is going to lead us off. What you're going to get today is basically a freebie, a bonus. You're getting two panels in one. We're going to do first a panel on the big picture of ebooks, featuring John and Brewster Kahle, who is the creator of the Wayback Machine, the Internet Archive, and he is a sort of a master digital librarian who's up to some very interesting tricks. Then there will be a short interlude. I couldn't help noticing that there's a grand piano sitting there. I don't know how that got there, but maybe I'll exploit that somehow. And then we have some representatives of individual ebook reading manufacturers, including Steve Haber, who's the head of Sony's electronic book industry. Steve has been at Sony for years. He used to run the entire audio, video, camera, camcorder, the big consumer electronics organization, just to show you how important Sony thinks e-readers are. They've moved them to this. Neil Jones, representing the scrappy startup with a new ebook reader he'll tell you about. And Mary Lou Jepson of Pixel Chi, who is developing a new ebook screen technology and netbook screen technology capable of color and video. So where are we today? I should mention a couple people who aren't here. Barnes & Noble is not here, as they're busy, no doubt, getting ready with this thing just announced, the Nook. The Nook is sort of like the Kindle, only it has both free cellular internet connectivity and free Wi-Fi and a color touch screen, and it costs the same price as Amazon Kindle. And Amazon is not here. They are currently hiding under a coffee table. not mentioned in all the hype about the Nook, I think very interestingly, is that if you take this thing into a Barnes & Noble store, you can not only use their free Wi-Fi, but read their 1 million books, end-to-end, page 1 to page 1,000, for free all day. And I gotta think, either the publishers hate this, or the publishers have agreed to it, which would be interesting either way. And you can lend books. You can lend books you bought for 2 weeks at a time to your friends with Nook. So, like I said, coffee table. So where are we? Where are we today? Well, yesterday, writing about this festival, the Boston Globe wrote something. Let's see if you can find the real screw-up in this open hearing. Book sales are down. Readership is on the decline. E-readers are transforming the notion of a page turner. And Google aims to digitize. Whoa! Which one of these things is not like the other? Okay, so book sales are down. That's a bad thing. Readership is on the decline. That's a bad thing. But e-readers are transforming. What? No, that doesn't fit at all with their thesis. When perfectly momentous time to launch the Boston Book Festival, they're trying to say, oh, reading sucks, the future looks terrible, da-da-da-da. But what they're missing is, yes, maybe physical book buying is down, but not ebooks. Ebooks are the most interesting thing going on. If the Boston Globe had read the New York Times, they would have read this a couple days ago. The publishing industry has been under a dark cloud, but amid the gloom, some sellers or owners of electronic book devices are making the case that people are reading more because of ebooks. Amazon says people with Kindles buy 3 times as many books as they did before they had the Kindle. And any of you have Kindles? I mean, it's obvious, right? Because they've lowered the barrier. Have you read Freakonomics? No, but I will right now. It's instant access to any book cellularly, right where you're standing, and usually at a discount. And I can tell you, when I was reviewing the Kindle, we had a review unit, and my 10-year-old daughter, who's a readaholic, trust me, she read a lot more than when she was reading books. It put me in a very awkward position, because she'd get hooked on these series, you know, a series of unfortunate events or whatever, and she's like, Dad, can I get number 31? How much is it? $6. Honey, can't you just go to the library? This is costing me a fortune.
You're going to tell your child not to read?
Go ahead.
What am I supposed to do?
You know, instead of just not smoking pot. Anyway. At the same time, on my last panel this morning, one of the other panelists said, well, clearly, paper books are dead. I think it's sad, but blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, wait a minute! Who said paper books are dead? Look, the history of technology is splintering. Everybody says, this is going to be the iPhone killer. This is going to be the iPod killer. This is going to be television. It's going to kill radio. Satellite radio is going to kill AM, FM. It never happens. I've been in this business long enough to know what happens in technology is when something new comes along, it just adds on. The audience may splinter. Look, in the beginning, if we wanted to keep on top of things, we had what? Books, newspapers, and magazines, right? And radio, TV. And then there came the internet, and then email, and then websites, and wikis, and blogs, and I don't know if these things on the bottom are, I made them up, but just give it time. So things don't replace things in this world, things just add on. And I guarantee you, 50 years from now, 100 years from now, there will be paper books. It's baloney to say X is going to replace Y. And the reasons are very obvious. We'll get to that in a minute. Right now, all of the ebook readers on the market and those about to come out are using the same display technology, grayscale, called e-ink. Very interesting. Basically, it magnetizes tiny, tiny black particles on the surface of the plastic. So it really looks like ink on paper because the black is right there on the surface. And it also uses no battery. Once it's formed the image of the page, no battery at all. They have an e-ink screen in Japan that's had the same page on the screen for 5 years. They're really sick of reading that paragraph. But no color, no video. It's black on gray, not black on white. And every time you turn the page, there's this really annoying flicker. The whole thing gets negative image, white for black, and then back to black for white as it brings up the next page. It has to do that to sort of demagnetize the whole page and readies this for the next one. So there's room for improvement there. In general, this is how we're doing in the ebook world. We like ebooks because they're light and they're high capacity. It's a pleasure to read because it looks like ink on paper. The prices are falling. The catalog of books is growing. I'm happy to announce that Amazon has just said that you can now read your Kindle books on the computer. Thank you. Not just the iPhone and the Kindle itself. Barnes & Noble's bookstore, you can already do that. Cooler's bookstore, you can already do that. You can adjust the type size when your eyes age. And as we've noted, it promotes reading and it promotes the concept of books. But we're not there yet because the selection is relatively tiny. I can't wait to get to our panel because these companies are all bragging. We have 800,000 books. We have 800,015. You know, they're all like arguing about who's got more books. But as I understand it, the same middleman companies supply the electronic books to all of them. So I don't even see why that's an arguing point, but we'll ask them about that. These things are so expensive and so fragile, it so ruins your week if you lose one on the movie theater seat or the Disney World ride. Not that I'm speaking from experience or anything. They're still copy protected. It really ticks me off that I buy a book, maybe close to full price, and once I'm done with it, it's stuck on that reader forever. I can't resell it. I can't even give it to the library. It's there permanently. Barnes & Noble's Nook will let you lend the book. That's halfway there. I'm going to be able to resell it. And of course, everybody's got their own format for these ebook files. Everyone who bought Kindles and is all excited about the library they've built up there will now be like, oh, but I can't read them on the Barnes & Noble one, which is better, so I'm screwed. Anyway, so with that, let's begin our exploration of the ebook world as it is now. I'd like to introduce John Orwant from Google Books, who's going to give us a big overview.
Dissipate some of my nervous energy. So I work for Google. I actually work not far away, so I manage the Google book search team, which is right over in Kendall Square in Cambridge. And My problem is that I'm both a publishing geek and a book, publishing geek and a computer geek. So when David Pogue and Nicholas Negroponte asked me to come and talk about the future of the book, it was natural for me to ask, well, what can we learn about what's going to happen to publishing from what's happening right now in computer science? And right now what's happening in computer science is computing in the cloud, cloud computing. So people are starting to believe that it can actually work. This notion that software doesn't have to be something that you download onto your local computer and use to manipulate data that is also on your local computer. If you think about mail programs like Gmail, where in contrast to some of the older mail systems in which all the mail is downloaded to your local PC, Gmail allows you to still download that mail, but also keeps it on the server. And so what's being served out of the cloud, out of the hazy, fuzzy internet out there, is both the data, and here's what's new, the logic, the computer logic that helps you to operate that data. You see the same thing with word processors, where you have this model of Microsoft Word, but you also have this model of Google Docs, where for free, you can just go and start editing text in your browser, and it will be stored for you in the cloud. So fine, that's email, that's word processing. Does this have a lesson for us for publishing? I believe the answer is yes, in that we're going to start seeing books in the cloud. And so what does that mean, right? So, I'm an engineer, not a salesman. I'm not here to pitch any particular product. We are going to start selling digital books called Google Editions. And here's how we could really screw things up, right? Google could really screw things up if we released a device, a hardware device e-reader, like some that we're about to see later today, but that was only able to let people read Google Books, or to package those Google Books, those Google Editions, in a format that can only be read on the device. And that might be something we would do if we were very, very short-sighted and simply wanted to maximize short-term sales of that device. So we're not going to do that. Rather, we want to create an environment in which you buy a book, regardless of whether it's a Google book or an Amazon book or a Barnes & Noble book or a public domain book, and be able to read that anywhere on any device. And I don't even like that word device, because device can mean a physical e-reader, like we're about to see in the second part of this presentation. It could also mean being able to read things via the browser on a computer or a netbook. It could also mean reading things on your mobile phone, because certainly we're starting to see a lot more uptake. People are reading a lot on their phones. Or it could mean reading things print on demand, so that you purchase a book in the cloud, but can then be able to get a printed copy mailed to you. And that's one of the, obviously, any sort of, any time that someone asks, well, which is going to win? Kind of like what David was talking about before, are e-books going to beat paper books? As though there can be only one winner, right? That is a false choice. There are advantages to each, right? Paper books have the portability, the tactile feel, the high resolution. And electronic books don't take up as much space. Hopefully they can be lent if we can create the technological infrastructure to permit that. And they allow you to see a book in context, right? You read some long Russian novel with 100 different characters in it, and they're all referred to by different names. This is Sasha, this is Alexander, you can't tell. An environment in which you can mouse over something and be brought immediately to the point at which that character was introduced, that would be a nice thing. If you're reading a novel about some faraway place, it would be nice to be able to call up a little description of what that place is with pictures. If you're reading a research paper or a newspaper article, it would be nice to be able to see commentary on that article as you're reading the article. And these are things that become much easier to do when you start thinking of the book as something that's dynamic, as something that's like a computer program instead of something that is simply static. So if you think about the, obviously we're here because we're all book lovers. If you think about the books that you have at home, right? How do you have those books organized? Well, some of you may not organize your books at all. Some of you may organize the books based on the person, right? If you have four people in your family, here are mom's books, here are dad's books, here are kids' books. You may organize them by subject. You may organize them by genre. I will tell you how you don't organize them. You don't organize them by, here are the books you bought from Barnes & Noble. Here are the books you bought from Amazon. Here are the books that were given to you as a gift. And we need to be very careful to make sure that we don't create an environment in which digital books end up that way. So, one of the advantages to digitizing books is that, when we talk about digitizing books, we don't want to think of it simply as kind of scanning in the pages and copying those pages to different devices for reading. Rather, you want to think of them as a starting point, as something from which you start to extract content and structure. So, what I mean by that is if you have a page of text, right, you want to be able to know, you want the computer to be able to figure out, what the elements are on that text. What are the flows? What are the columns? What are the index entries? The fun just continues. So like two things happen in such a rapid succession, there has to be a third. So one of the things we want to be able to do is to start extracting the structure of books, right? To have computers be able to look at a book and identify what's a footnote, what's an index entry, what's a table of contents, what's a sidebar. And because only once you do that are you really going to be able to render content, render books on a variety of different devices. So, an example of that is, just think about something as simple as italics. So it's not hard for a computer, as it does optical character recognition, to identify when something is italics. What is hard is identifying what that italics means. Does it mean that the author is trying to emphasize a word? Does it mean that in a bit of dialogue that word should be spoken at a higher volume? That's something you want to know if you're converting books to audiobooks, right, for the visually impaired. Or is it in italics because it's a foreign phrase? Is it in italics because it's a mathematical expression? So this is what we're working on inside Google. Being able to take the printed pages of all the books that we're digitizing and understand the content that's there. Now, when you're a computer geek, I'm putting on my computer geek hat again, and you want to develop algorithms like that, what you need is a tremendous amount of data. You want lots and lots of books to train your algorithms on. And at this point, this is kind of one of the side benefits of the digitization effort that we have at Google. We've now digitized over 10 million books. And the way to think about that is, since the dawn of Gutenberg, every book that has ever been published, we have 10% digitized. I have a daughter in first grade. It is my hope and expectation that by the time she enters college, essentially it would go without saying that books exist in some digital form. We've digitized 2 trillion words at this point. We have 478 different languages. I was actually just calculating that a week ago for a different presentation we were doing to the for a conference for the libraries at which we're scanning. And I found out that we have 3 books scanned in Klingon. Go figure. And this is useful for things like automated translation algorithms, where if you want to use Google Translate to be able to translate between one book and another, that actually uses our book corpus to train, because it's very hard to get samples of a lot of the languages that are out there. So once you're able to extract the content and to extract the structure and be able to render it into all these different formats, that's one part of the publishing supply chain in which the costs go down substantially. And once we can start doing, once those costs go down, it'll be an interesting choice for the publishing industry to see where they take that. So, one solution might be to simply publish more books, where if it becomes cheaper for a publisher to publish a book, maybe where they have to make an acquisition decision and decide, well, we definitely want to publish this, we definitely don't want to publish this, and this is just on the edge, but times are tight, so we won't publish that. Now they can move that line just a little bit, and they can publish more books. And I think that would actually be the wrong way to think about things, because, look, we're all book lovers here. We hear talk about the book publishing industry being in decline, and the unit sales are actually relatively constant. But the problem is in the tail of books, right? It's the Dan Browns that are leading to kind of this perception that the industry is still doing just fine. And if we really want to kind of reach out to new readers, what's the big problem with publishing? It's that there aren't as many readers. Real problem is reality TV, right? if you have people who are watching, you know, 10 hours a week of television, we're not suddenly, by publishing, you know, twice as many books in a year, be able to get those people starting to spend 4 hours reading. Instead, what we need to do is to use the upcoming cheaper costs of publishing, because it's going to get a lot easier for everyone to get published. You know, there are a lot of stories out there that, you know, aren't being told because of the capital investment that a publisher has to put behind a book, behind the printing and manufacturing costs, behind the editorial costs, behind the distribution and marketing costs. And as those costs go down, more things are going to be published. And if we're going to take those people and give them a compelling alternative to reality TV, what we have to start publishing are more targeted books, books that appeal to smaller and smaller niches of people, which is not something that would have been possible before when to publish a book meant to get a press run of 10,000 or 100,000 copies. So with that, I'm optimistic about the state of publishing, and I'll pass it back to David.
Wait, have a seat. So it seems to me, it seems to me, John, that the 800-pound gorilla in the room that you haven't mentioned, I mean, that was great, by the way, but is the Google scanning effort. So, and I even though it's my job to keep on top of this, I am confused. Can you differentiate for me this out of copyright book project and the scanning of all book projects that the publishers object? Somebody sued you over something, and so what is it that you're scanning? To what end? Why do people not trust it, and why are they suing you?
So the way to think about it is that there are about 100 million books in the world. Roughly 20% of those are in the public domain. They belong to the world, right? No one owns them. You can do whatever you want with them.
Because the authors are dead and it's been 70 years.
Copyright law is a wonderful morass and it varies from country to country, but yes, basically it's been long enough that the book is, you know, that the term of copyright has expired and the book has gone into the public domain.
The Bible.
Yeah, well, the Bible's an interesting question.
It was a joke, forget it!
We need to take a total right turn and talk about nothing but religion. But you mentioned the Bible, so I have to, you know, obviously most copies of the Bible are very, very old. However, the British government actually maintains a copyright on the King James Version. It's a little tidbit there, but to answer your question. So 100 million books, 20% are in the public domain. About, you know, 10% or so are in print, meaning you can, you know, go to Barnes & Noble, go to Borders, you know, order them online via Amazon New. And in between, we have this huge twilight zone of books. So 70% of all the books that are out there are in copyright, but out of print. So there's no way to effectively get them unless you kind of luck out in a used bookstore. And so Google has, in its attempts to organize the world's information, make it universally accessible and useful, when you join Google, you have to learn more.
Is that the motion?
So, you know, a broader question might be, why the hell is Google doing this, right? We're a search engine company. But if you look at that model, there's nothing there about the web. We're really about answering people's questions, regardless of where the answer to that question lies, right? That answer might be on the web, it might be in a newspaper article, it might be in an image, in a YouTube video, or in a book. So we're trying to digitize all of the world's books. Now with the public domain stuff, there's no issue whatsoever, right? Because those belong to the world. No one can say that you can't scan a public domain book. But what about these books in the Twilight Zone? What about these books that are basically, you know, they're on library shelves, and typically not public libraries, but university library shelves, the really obscure stuff. We made agreements with those libraries, no money changes hands or anything like that, to start scanning those books. And the libraries like it because it gives them archival copies. It gives them things that they can serve to their patrons electronically. And what we did was we started scanning all of those books so that we could then show snippets of text. So people would search for a particular phrase and we'd be able to show a couple lines from that book saying, here, that appeared on page 73 of this particular book, or on page 22 of that other book.
You can't read the whole book?
You cannot read the whole book, correct.
Can't I search for the and therefore read every single page?
No, you can't, actually. We thought about that. So the question is, you know, should we be able to do that? We are scanning books, and let's be frank about it, kind of without the express written consent of the rights holder. And the problem is that a lot of these rights holders don't exist anymore, or they can be very hard to find, or more likely, they just don't care anymore. You know, the first book that I wrote, that is a programming book, it is now out of print, and it's worth nothing, right? So I managed to kind of send in notice to the publisher. I'll probably try to figure out how I can get the content of that book and just release it to the world for free, because I'd much rather have kind of my ideas out there than the $10 a year or whatever that I would be able to make from royalties. So we started to scan all of these books, and sure enough, back in 2005, we were sued by the Authors and Publishers of the United States. And so normally, like had I been CEO of Google at the time, it's a good thing that I wasn't, because I would have said, what the hell, this is fair use. We're going to keep doing this. We're not letting people read the entire book. We're simply showing snippets. U.S. copyright law allows for that sort of use. And that's still our position. However, what I've now realized is that kind of when big companies get together and sue each other, really it's a suggestion to kind of sit down. And so we sat down for several years and came up with a settlement agreement. What that settlement agreement enables us to do is to, first of all, keep scanning. It allows us to open up, it allows us to kind of basically create a website where any rights holder, so rights holder means kind of either publisher or author, kind of whoever has the copyright at the time, to come forward and say, this is my book, and Google, I don't want you to have anything to do with it. It allows them to say, Google, I want to take that book out, and I'm going to start selling print on demand through Amazon. Or it allows them to say, Google, you could start selling that book. And so we want to be able to start doing that. It allows us to create a public access terminal in every single public library building in the United States, giving people free access to all of these books. It allows us to do a more limited version of that for university libraries as well. It allows us to create an institutional subscription, so libraries will be able to subscribe to essentially all of the world's out-of-print books. And since we also have deals with current publishers as well, there would be frontlist content, kind of modern books in there as well. It allows us to render these books in ways that are consumable by people with print disabilities, so that means people that are blind, maybe paralyzed and unable to turn a page of a book.
We're getting paper cuts a lot.
They might have severe dyslexia, making it difficult for them to read, so they would therefore benefit from audio versions as well. It allows us to create a research corpus as well that allows data mining on books that are out there. And there was there's some researchers that we've been working with at Harvard and MIT that recently released a paper based on kind of analyses that were made possible out of all the books that we've scanned that help us to identify kind of how patterns in language have changed over the years.
So everybody's happy now?
Well, everyone's happy. What are you going to say next if I just say yes, everyone's happy?
I would introduce Brewster.
Yeah, so where we are right now, and I don't want to get into the vagaries of class action law because it bores me to tears. We have the settlement agreement, the authors agree to it, the publishers agree to it, Google has agreed to it, various other parties have agreed to it. And we're currently trying to figure out how to amend that agreement so that it's palatable to everyone. And this is all something that's going to happen over the next month or two. But hopefully, all of that will get resolved and we can start delivering these services and opening up all of this content. And I forgot to mention kind of the biggest single advantage of the settlement agreement is all of these books that we've digitized that are just in this snippet view, only allowing you to see about, only allowing you to see a few lines, you'll now be able to see 20% of that book as well.
John Orwan from Google. Thank you very much. Take us home.
I get to be the other side. You may not know the Internet Archive anywhere near as well as Google. It wouldn't be terribly surprising. So I'm going to give you a quick overview and then discuss sort of the evolution of books on the web and how it could either end sort of where John would like it to, or it could move forward into a very interesting, rich future for books. something that's an interesting sort of... books are really the product of the Enlightenment in terms of how it's really played out in our democracy. There are lots of winners, there are lots of interplay. It's how we discuss things. They're very, very important. I'd say they're more important, really, than, oh, I know, music within our culture. Right? If we screw this one up, we're in trouble. So it is worth time and effort to try to get this right. But let me just give a little bit of an idea of the Internet Archive. The Internet Archive is a nonprofit library located in San Francisco. Our mission is universal access to all knowledge. The idea is to have everything published ever since Sumerian tablets available to everybody. Some of it will be for pay, some of it will be for free. But the idea is we're built within the library framework, and that's what we're here to build. Above the Boston Public Library door, the McKean, Mead, and White, I find this perpetual, whenever I walk through that door, I love reading it. It says, free to all. And it doesn't mean that nobody's making any money. There's a lot of money that goes into building this building and running the library system. It's a $12 billion a year industry, just in the United States. Across the world, it's $31 billion, and between a quarter and a third of that, so just the United States, $3 or $4 billion goes to publishers' products. It really keeps a large part of the book publishing industry alive, is the library system and how that works. And I think it's a good thing. Right? It's what I grew up with, and it's what I think I benefited from, and so the idea is to continue it. To try to get there, we've started recording a lot of things. It's called the Internet Archive, because we're good at recording things. So we have 100,000 hours of television, Russian, Chinese, Japanese, Iraqi, Al Jazeera, BBC, CNN, NBC, Fox, 24 hours a day, DVD quality. It's a big TiVo box. We have 200,000 moving images at this point. People can upload those. They're digitized old materials and making those available. There are 400,000 audio recordings, 10,078, plus a lot of concert recordings, lots of different kinds of audio recordings, free hosted on the internet for free at Archive there. Books, we have 1,600,000 books publicly available on the Internet Archive from many projects, including about half of them are actually from Google's project. There's people that are users that are very energetic to go and download these and upload them into the Internet Archive. And so there's about 1,600,000 books that are available for free public download and in mass, and so that this can be basically gathered up, and I'll talk about that a little bit more. What we're probably best known for is collecting the World Wide Web. And we've been collecting a snapshot of the World Wide Web every 2 months since 1996. And so it's of every web page, every website, every image on every web page. That's what we attempt anyway. Every 2 months. And it's enormous. But it's such a rich resource. The average web page lasts 100 days. So if you don't collect it immediately, there will be nothing left. It's not like there's an out-of-print web page, except potentially within the Internet Archive. So we have 150 billion of them. We're collecting about 4 to 6 billion of them every month. So in terms of the amount of information that is, it's about a Library of Congress a month. If you take all the words in the Library of Congress and just do it in ASCII, in like a Microsoft Word file, it's about that much we collect every month. So the web is very large. But it's not necessarily, the best, right? We've got a lot of things in books as well. So, Internet Archive basically has all these things. And we work within policy, we work with a lot of national libraries, we work with a lot of publishers, and trying to evolve this whole situation forward. We're very technical. I come from MIT as well, and we're a bunch of us that helped build some of the early internet. But let's talk about the evolution of books on the internet. Well, how many are there? There may be 100 million everywhere. At least we can point to one library that has, they say, 26 million books. So it's the Library of Congress. It's the largest print library by far of any of them that exists in the world. So about 26 million books. If you were to be selective, if you go to the Harvards or the Yales or the Princetons or the Boston Public Libraries, and if you got 10 million books and you sort of were, if you're really good at picking, a million books would probably do for a K-12 undergraduate and graduate research. If you weren't that picky, 10 million books, is probably kind of the universe of books. And of course, if you're bad at it, you have to just keep going and going until you find all the good books. But that's sort of the scope of sort of how hard is it. And it's been moving along. This is a picture of, actually I believe a librarian from Brown University, scanning upstairs here in the Boston Public Library at a scanning center operated by the Internet Archive. And I highly recommend you storm out of here and go see it. And better yet, bring 10 books. Because there's a scanning center supported by the Boston Public Library here that's been digitizing for years. And it takes books from all sorts of colleges, universities, all sorts of, there's a book cart full of old Yiddish books, a language that was almost wiped out. And that's upstairs, and if you want to see those books before they get digitized, they're there as well. And of course, after they're digitized, they're free and public on that. This is what it looks like at the University of Toronto. We operate 20 scanning centers in 5 countries. And these are all manually operated, people turning pages. We digitize about 1,000 books every day. We're in the Library of Congress itself and the Adams Building, et cetera, et cetera. So we've now gotten good at digitizing, putting books online. If you do things in phenomenal, really great quality, color, beautiful, it's 10 cents a page. So about $30 a book. So 10 million books times $30 is $300 million. That's if you do things really beautifully. There are people that have figured out how to do things really quickly, and it's a lot cheaper if you do that. But if you do things beautifully, it's about 10 cents a page for everything. Metadata, doing all the OCR, packaging, storing it on 2 continents so that it's safe against different kinds of disruptions. Anyway, so 10 cents a page is what it costs. So what we're talking about in terms of digitizing 10 million books is a $300 million expense out of a $12 billion a year industry, which is the library system. So it's not that big a deal to go off and do this. What do you get out of it? Well, you get really washed out slogs of books online. You can search them. There are different page turning interfaces. There's lots of different interfaces that are coming about now, which is fabulous. And it's another one of those reasons why you want to have open access to these materials. So you can hoover them down and put them into new ways of viewing it to make it relevant to the next generation, or to make it relevant to particular scientific groups or particular linguists or whatever. You want to be able to download these things en masse. And openness is the only way to get there. So one thing that I kind of like, I have to say, I like books. You know, books. And one of the great things you can do with these books is you can print them back out again. And you can give them away because they're cheap. And at least if they're out of copyright. And I have some. Would you mind?
Now, unless you have enough for everybody.
Just claw each other. Anyway, you can see that these print-on-demand books are really quite good-looking. And we built a bookmobile, a small bookmobile, like a soccer mom-mobile with a satellite dish. You can download, print, and bind a book. A 100-page book, like an Alice in Wonderland short book, is $1 a book. At $1 a book, you can give books away. Because at $1 a book, that's less than what it costs to loan a book from a library and get it back and put it on the shelf. Harvard says it costs them $3, and I think they're actually probably too low. But anyway, so if it costs $3 to loan a book, if it's out of copyright, at least let's give it away. Hey, let's cost $2 and give $1 back to authors. And I asked some authors, would you be up for that? $1? And they said, $1 a book? I've never gotten $1 a book. $1 a book? Sign me up, I'm on for that. The idea of going out and doing bookmobiles caught on a bit. This is Eric Eldred, one of the last times that we've ended up in court trying to keep openness happening. That one got to the Supreme Court, and this is in front of his bookmobile at Walden. And he was printing copies of Thoreau's works before he got kicked out by the Park Service for competing with the bookstore. Okay, so there's something quite in on the clue, but anyway, there's a couple of them have been trying out in India. This is the first day at the Library of Alexandria in Egypt. So they can go and download, print, and find books. Here's an engineer working with a kid and a happy patron with the first book he's ever owned. So the idea that this digitization stuff is just going to lead to websites or e-readers with licenses isn't necessarily the case if you're open. If you're open towards having people come by and use these in new and different ways, all sorts of really cool things happen.
This is the launch day in Uganda. So to try out having print on demand, and can we get our books from Harvard, MIT, Library of Congress into rural Uganda? And it works quite well. What we learned from this is the books weren't good enough. We had a lot of old books, but we didn't have a lot of the current books that they were looking for, and hence some of the problems that we're running into that John mentioned. There's print-on-demand machines have gotten better and easier. This is an early version of a print-on-demand machine. I think that the Harvard Book Cafe just bought one of these things. And we worked with them with this manufacturer to make sure all of our books were available through this. So that's all available and being done. And so it basically is a Rube Goldberg machine. It's completely weird to watch. And it comes out with this sort of shoo. And I think they've gotten it to be a little bit better than this era machine, but it's pretty darn cool. So the idea of doing, even if what we do is digitize, put it through the wires, and then print it back out again, that's kind of cool. It's not as far as we can go. There's other things we can do. We can data mine them and stuff like that. But let's at least get our books to everybody we possibly can. One thing I'm quite excited about is the One Laptop Per Child, which is a brainchild from MIT, and to make a computer that would work for the developing world. And I'll have more to say about that in a moment, but it makes a really good e-reader.
Bruce, what do you do?
Okay, I'm moving really fast.
Yeah.
Okay, so here's the one of the big problems. We've got public domain, as John said, is about 20%. 70% are out of print, and 10% are in print. And right now there's a grab for the out of print. How is that going to be dealt with? And that's going to be an enormous problem. I'm going to suggest, and we launched this on Monday, a distributed system of loaning and vending on the internet. How do we have it so there are lots of winners? There are lots of publishers going forward, that libraries have a role going forward, that they don't just give over their books to a couple of companies or nonprofits that go and hoover these things up and put them on one place. How do we have the Boston Public Library serving books and relevant books to people? Well, let's do it the way publishers and libraries have always worked. Let's have publishers and booksellers selling books, not just a few centralized organizations. Having one, two, or three does not make competition. Having tens of thousands is how you make an ecology that works. Can you make libraries that loan? And we went and used a Sony reader on Monday and borrowed a book from the Internet Archive that was in out of print but in copyright. And using digital rights management that was bundled on the Sony. So the idea is we actually showed borrowing from a library remotely. So the key concept here is there are lots of readers, but there are lots of sources of books. If we don't do that, we could lose the whole ball of wax. And you'll hear a bunch of more about, being centralized with lots of readers. We need lots of sources and lots of readers, and under the rule of law. So then I come back to the One Laptop Per Child. We've been working for the last year, since Nicholas invited us to this, to show something and demonstrate something and announce something. So we took all of the 1,600,000 books and have reformatted them and worked with the One Laptop Per Child group such that the 1 million kids that already have this and all the ones in the future will now have a library that's bigger than 95% of the libraries in the world. So that's our announcement for today. So there are lots of devices coming out. I kind of like paper, but the idea is we're in a great position now to have lots of winners, lots of reader technologies, lots of publishers, and lots of libraries all participating to build a rich future for books. Thank you very much.
Well, let me ask you, just one quick thing. So the 1.6 billion books, yeah. Is there anything there anyone want to read? I'm serious. I mean, all these, you know, free Google, out of copyright stuff I've looked through, it's just like, okay, you know, Little House on the Prairie and Tom Sawyer, but
it's old, like, stuff.
Old stuff.
It's a lot of great.
For the One Laptop Per Child, we have the books that are public domain. For the Sony, we actually get all the way through out of print, which most books, do you have any books that are out of print?
Yeah.
Are they?
iPhoto 2, The Missing Manual.
At least your kids really want to get to that. And so by putting in place all of these different components, the old books are good for classics. They're the classics. And there's a lot of other stuff. Mm-hmm. And it's good research materials for different people that are into particular areas. But it's not a complete library. It's one of the troika.
Right.
So I think we've got the out of copyright stuff going really well. And right now the battle is really going on around who's is anybody or who's going to control the out of print.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks, sir.
And thank you, Jim. So the other player that's on everybody's lips in the electronic book thing is Apple, who has this rumored giant iPod Touch called the Tablet, which as far as I'm concerned is still a rumor. Everyone's like, what do you think of it? Is an SD card slot enough? Like, what? It's just still a rumor. And they're like copying specs down. But anyway, in honor of this great killer, ebook killer that they're saying exists in Apple's mind, I thought I would treat you to a small music company as a teenager, built it up to a $200 million company, and then was fired by the Apple board because he did not have the business acumen to run a large corporation. You're going to get this irony in a minute. So he spent a few years away, starting Next and doing other stuff. And then in 1997, Apple was going down the drain. They begged him to return. And I was at the Macworld Expo where Steve Jobs came back to Apple, and he came to the front of the stage like this. The crowd went insane. And I had just seen the movie Evita. And I'm like, where have I seen this before? It won't be easy. You think I'm just reading when I try to explain why I'm back. After telling the press Apple's future is black, you won't believe me. All that you see is a kid in his teens who started out in a garage with only a bunny named Watts. You try rhyming with garage.